Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. I think I've forewarned everybody that there may become points in time, just due to my condition, my medical condition, that I won't be able to do shows. And so as much as I really want to do the shows, I really have to put focus on my health. And so we basically were unable to air. I had a conflict. I had to be in front of a specialist, which I had the opportunity of, but I don't want to get into the details of that, at least not until I have the opportunity to inform the family first. And we'll kind of give you a view of what's going to happen. Hopefully things will be, you know, really, really aggressive. It's still, you know, hard to... We'll talk about it later. Let me just focus on the special show we have today. I know currently we are working through this realigning the Constitution to today's society as well as to the 21st century, because there are way too many people that have not been taught some important parts of the Constitution. I can't emphasize it enough. The fact that we need to understand bills of attainder and ex post facto laws. And that's just two little teeny things that the government is restricted from doing. That doesn't, you know, include, you know, the enumerated powers, the enumerated lands and properties the federal government can possess and operate. All of these types of things, all of these things are absolutely critical for every American to understand. So you know, we have advanced in some ways as far as being able to comprehend and understand. When I talk about contract law, basic contract law, almost everybody gets it and almost everybody understands it. Back in those days, you know, contract law wasn't necessarily a thing of common knowledge. But back in those days, there were other things that were common knowledge, and we don't have those things. We've lost those things. And so there's no reason why today's society cannot understand this Constitution, its design, its layout, and its brilliance in how the people of this nation were to be protected from tyranny. Now, unfortunately, over the past 200 some years, we've had, you know, the issues of ending slavery and then turning right back into becoming racially oppressive, not necessarily by the people, but there were people. And as a matter of fact, there's been bad players on all sides, period, from the very beginning, even with the quote-unquote indigenous people, there have been bad players on all sides. It is what it is. What we have to actually start, you know, there's that old grade school, you know, two wrongs don't make a right. Well, we got to stop making wrongs. We got to start making rights. And we got to start moving forward, because we've had all of the opportunities and we've missed too many. And it's time to start getting it right. Period. So we got a conversation with Keith Broders coming up. And so we're going to be talking about the Electoral College. I have the highest regard for Keith Broders. He is a guy that dives into details. And there's a lot of things that we really want to help you see and understand what the heck's going on. This way you can kind of see, wow, okay, these things are really happening. We want to move paradigms to so that people understand that the party can be far more effective in leading the community than what it is doing today. The two parties are only, they're just basically self-licking ice cream cones, taking care of themselves and their own agenda. This is why yours truly has been hammering and yammering about a legitimate third party. And so what we want to do is, as soon as we go into break, we're not going to go into a promo. We're going to go straight into this conversation and interview we have with Keith Broders. And then right when we come back, I'll kind of, you know, give you a prep of how much time I've got left. I don't have a lot of time. This is a good, nice, long conversation with Keith Birders regarding the Electoral College, and we will have him back. We'll have him back very soon, and we'll have him contribute to a lot of things, because there's a lot of things he's doing, and we're kind of working in. We'll give you all the information when that comes up. That being said, as you know, the show is also sponsored by RepublicReview.org, and you are listening to the only show that gives you the academic evidence and the academic evidence-based solutions of what we need to do if we're going to save this nation. Now, I don't have time to do the personal endorsements today, but you know who they are. You know who we endorse and who we stand with. And so anyway, we stand with you as well, but when we come back after this promo, or actually, we're not even going to have a problem. We're going to go straight into that interview. So when we come right back after the music, it will be me and Keith having a deep discussion about the Electoral College. So we'll be right with you on that conversation. Thank you so much. Folks, we've got Keith Birders. It's been a long time since you've been on the show, Keith. I think probably a couple of years now, hasn't it?
Probably.
Okay. So I was hoping that we could finally connect and talking about, because I know you did a lot of research and we talked about that. And I thank you for coming back on. I would love to have you on more because you have so much knowledge. You do a lot of great detailed research into a lot of these different topics, and the Electoral College is one of them. And most people do not even understand why we have an Electoral College, because we are not to have direct democracy, right? I mean, what is it you always call it?
Well, obviously, we have if you have a democracy, the will of the majority is going to prevail. And our founding fathers knew that tyranny of the majority and tyranny of the minority both resulted in the same situation. So they wanted to try to create a system whereby which the rights of the people would be secure and the rights of individuals would not be abused by the tyranny of either a majority or a minority.
Right. Okay, great. And so let's just talk about the design of the Electoral College. Clearly, the Constitution gave the state legislators the control over the manner in choosing the electors. Now, I believe that the intent behind the manner of choosing the electors had twofold. One, the first part of that was that the legislators were to decide how the electors for the different seats of government. In other words, you had the Senate, each state got two electoral college votes for, and how they also had representation of the people in the congressional district. So they got one elector for each congressional district. So, you know, let's just say, for an example, there were two electoral electors, and then there were seven electors for the House. So I believe the intent behind this was that the state legislators would determine, because at that point in time, the state legislators had control over who was to represent them in the Senate. And so it would have made sense to me, or common, that the state legislators would have been able to say, you know what, we believe that those two electors should be appointed by the legislature, by both houses of the legislature, and just like we do with senators. But the electors would be based on the qualifications of the Constitution, which is the same qualifications as a representative. And then that the seats for the representative, and I'm just giving you a scenario, but the seats for the representatives, such as the congressional district representatives, those would be voted by the people of each of their electoral, or I should say their congressional district, and that those electors would then cast their ballot. There was no such thing as party. There was no such thing as, you know, primaries or, you know, tickets. And as a matter of fact, what they did was they voted initially mentioning two names on one ballot, and one of those names could not be a resident of that state. And that was it. Is that about right?
Yeah, except one thing. Okay. Going back to the fact that the members of the state legislature could, frankly, they could choose an elector for a congressional district, or they could allow the people in the district to vote. It was either or. And initially, what the founders wanted is they wanted, frankly, they wanted to have the electors to represent the congressional districts where they lived. And that was their intent. It wasn't until the election of Andrew Jackson that they started taking the they started allowing the electors to be chosen on a statewide basis, and this created the opportunity for the tyranny of the majority. Say, for example, in California, you have such a tremendously large number of votes coming out of Los Angeles County. It created a situation where the city and county of Los Angeles would have the ability, essentially, to elect all of the electors for the entire state, which basically created that tyranny of the majority, which the founding fathers were intent on preventing.
Right, right. So to be clear, though, to be a Republican form of government, I think that it would have been a going down that other path of like a, almost, what's the word for it? An aristocracy where a ruling class would basically be the ones that would be choosing the president instead of the people. So that's probably why they started moving towards that, because they wanted the people to be represented. But the scenario I gave you would have been, you know, it would have been equally appropriate and equally constitutional for the state legislators to choose their two electors and let the people choose theirs, because as a representative government, those electors are actually represented. Because what would happen if they couldn't choose a president? If they couldn't come up with, in the original context of the Electoral College before the 12th Amendment, well, they had to continually vote, or if they couldn't come up with a clear majority, then it would go to the House and the Senate, right?
Correct.
And so the House would actually be the ones that would choose the president, and the Senate would be the ones choosing the vice president, correct?
That is also correct.
And so I think the whole intent was that, one, they wanted to kind of give the electors the freedom to choose who they felt was best. And they wanted to, I think the intent of the framers, maybe not necessarily embraced by everybody, but I think they wanted to try to maintain this dual sovereignty system that they created. That's why Congress had a dual sovereignty. The electors for the Senate would be more concerned with the candidates that would be more in line with what the states are concerned about versus the people. Now, the people, the things that concern the people is going to war and paying taxes. The things that the Senate is concerned with is, you know, economic treaties and trade and those types of things. You know, are we going to get our products equally represented in the marketplace around the world and through the United States or what have you, and making sure that the state's being taken care of. And so that was just one scenario. But bottom line, they could have done it at large, you know, doing both seats at large so that you can choose your elector statewide. Or actually another scenario is that they could have taken those two seats for the Senate and divided the state and said, okay, since we kind of split the state by population, this half of the state will vote for this elector and this half of the state will vote for that elector. There's just, my point is that they could have gone down a lot of different paths of how to choose those electors and the manner of choosing them. But they started gravitating towards this principle of general elections for all of the electors. Is that not correct?
Well, I think that let's back up for just a minute. When the first Electoral College voted, there were 69 electoral votes. As it turned out, George Washington got all of them. And at that particular time, the electors were, again, the method of choosing the electors was not mandated in the Constitution. The state legislatures had the ability to pick the electors according to their own methods. Some of the states did it on the basis of the fact that the electors were chosen by the legislatures of the states, and some of the states basically gave that responsibility to the voters in the congressional districts. But like I said, the changes really took place after the election of Andrew Jackson. At that point, basically all of the states went along with the idea that the electors would be chosen on a at a statewide at large basis. And that's essentially, again, that was, that created a problem, because that meant that the large urban counties would completely drown the voice out of the people living in the congressional districts that were much, much smaller. The whole concept of the Great Compromise of Roger Sherman was essentially was to make sure that the large states would not have the ability to dominate the small states, and that the small states wouldn't have an opportunity to dominate the large states. And this principle that was introduced by Roger Sherman was abandoned in the Electoral College after the election of Andrew Jackson, when the states basically went onto an at-large basis and basically disenfranchised the people living in the rural counties.
Right. Well, so let me throw this in there, too, because the language in the Constitution, both Article 2, Section 1, Subsection 2, as well as the 12th Amendment, the language is that the state legislature shall choose the manner, not the outcome. In other words, they have no power to dictate the outcome.
Which they are doing anyway.
That's what they're doing today. And as a matter of fact, as they started moving down that path, they literally have done that because in a representative form of government, it is repugnant to have the people choose one representative to represent them, their elector, and then have the state legislators come right back and say, it doesn't matter how you chose for your elector in your congressional district. The state, we're using a, as you call it, tyranny by the majority, and we're allowing a democratic process instead of a Republican process for this state, which they can't do. Constitutionally, they cannot be doing this winner takes all, nor the tickets, nor even the primaries, because they're just to have a choosing of the electors, which is not a part of a primary process.
Yes, I agree with you.
And so, anyway, I'm sorry. What I was trying to actually provide the listeners was there is all sorts of ways that the state legislators constitutionally can, you know, go down a path of allowing the choosing of the electors, the manner of how they're chosen, but they cannot determine the outcome. But that's exactly what they've done.
Well, the other thing that is a problem is the fact that when these electors are chosen, they are supposed to be obviously be independent. You're supposed to choose the electors on the basis of their integrity, their wisdom, and their good judgment. And if you have the system as we have it today, you could have people with Down syndrome filling all the electoral all of the positions, because all they have to do is just simply rubber stamp what the political parties demand.
Right.
And I think one of the things that we need to have the states do is to put on their big boy pants and say, look, we're going to do what they do in Nebraska and Maine. Right. We're going to divide the electoral votes between the candidates, not giving all of the votes to the winner, because what we're doing is we're disenfranchising up to 49% of the voters. Their votes are not being counted.
Right.
They're being thrown into the trash basket.
Right. Well, so one of the purposes of this conversation was to, one, identify that process. And so I never drilled into, like you have, I've never taken the time, because I'm always working on, you know, this solution of Republic Review, since this has been dominant since like 2013 for me. But I have taken some time, and I did look into the 1800 election. And the 1800 election was really and truly the only coup that was successfully pulled off in a changing of paradigms, and not by stealing of votes or voter fraud, election fraud, and those types of things like what we saw in 2020. What they did, but I also drilled into the 1808 election, because that's one of the most interesting elections that we've ever had, because there was hardly any campaigning. Madison did not campaign for the 1808 election. He didn't spend any time or any money. I believe he didn't spend any time or any money, but I know he spent a little bit of time, because all he did was he reached out to those electors who were chosen for, you know, who chose Jefferson, who got elected to choosing Jefferson. He reached out to them and said, you know, you'll have the same kind of government with me as you did with Jefferson, kind of thing. And that was about the extent of his effort in campaigning. And he won. He didn't win it wasn't a landslide like Monroe, but still he was able to keep the office. And because under his administration, because of the War of 1812 was brewing at that point in time, and we were going into that because that was the next election year, it forced him to actually say, you need to keep me, and this is why. And so anyway,
one of the questions I wanted to ask you is, sure. Is that there was no provision that when an elector was selected, was he selected for only 1 4-year cycle, or was he elected for life?
Well, so when an elector was selected, he was selected for that. So every 4 years, the people vote for their elector. The problem is, and it's not a compensated position, it's a position of honor, just kind of like the sheriffs were in England. The sheriffs were really not paid. They were just, and they were more of a figurehead for like these princes, you know, the people that are way down the food chain in the royal family. And they became sheriffs or what have you. And so they had castles, and they were the ones that went out and taxed the people, took their money, and they were the ones that conducted the voting. The same thing in America. The sheriff was the one who conducted the voting back in those days. And one thing I did learn is that if the sheriff didn't know you, because you went by county and you had to go to the county seat to vote, and if the sheriff didn't know you and he didn't know that you were a landowner, he would not allow you to vote. And so, and because you had to pay a poll tax as well, even if you're willing to pay the poll tax and all these other things, he would not allow you to vote because, he doesn't know you. Maybe the next election he'll have to come out and visit you, because that's how it was done back in those days. Anyway, it didn't become this huge profession because crime had become a huge profession in America as well. But anyway, back to the election of the electors. The electors was really a one-time application, but I truly believe that if you look at the Electoral College back in those days, you had one elector for every 30,000 people, just like you had one representative, right? Because that's how many people you were representing for the state at the time. For every 30,000 people, you were getting one elector. And so I think it was interesting that they were creating these guys that were really underutilized, because we've talked about this before, that these electors could also be utilized in selecting governors. They could be utilized in selecting every general position, attorney general, you know, any statewide, so that the people do not, so that we would never have gotten down this path of doing direct elections for our politicians, only our representatives.
Well, that would take money out of politics to a large degree, which would take away the potential for corruption.
Well, or it could. Well, so if you look at the way they broke the Constitution by changing representation from 30,000 to just dividing representation by the amount of seats in Congress, you know, we now have basically one person to represent a million. I mean, in some states, I think you'll find that there are representatives for, you know, over a million, or yeah, well, I think in South Dakota, they only have one representative, and they almost have a million. I think Montana is the same way. They have a little over a million, but they don't have a second representative. And so,
This makes a complete mockery of the idea that the House of Representatives is supposed to be based on proportional representation.
Right.
Proportional representation means that the number of representatives is an equation based on a ratio.
Right.
But that does not exist. Our House of Representatives is not based on equal representation. It's based on arbitrary representation. And this is obviously a big problem. The other point that I wanted to make is that Nebraska and Maine are the only two states, like I said, that allow the electoral votes to be separated into so that both candidates receive electoral votes. And I believe that the 48 states right now that implement the winner-take-all situation, they need to get on board with Nebraska and Maine and end this winner-take-all system, because the winner-take-all system is exactly what the Founding Fathers were trying to prevent. They did not want the majority to squash the rights of the minority.
Right, or a popular vote. Correct. So let me get back to the original, the history of the Electoral College, because basically what you're saying is that for the most part, up until 1830, or actually it was 1828, I think.
Yes.
1828, when Andrew Jackson won his seat, it was at that point in time where they actually started migrating towards, you know, that concept. Now, they still had electors, and they weren't doing necessarily popular vote or any of this party crap that they were doing today, excuse the French. It is a four-letter word, by the way. But anywho, the point I'm trying to make is when we look at the first time we actually had a problem in the choosing of the president was 1800, right? Because that gave us the 12th Amendment.
Right.
And so if you look at, and this is the point I want to drive home. If you look, and I know you probably have, when you compare the 12th Amendment to Article 2, subsection, or Section 1, Subsection 2, you know, the process of breaking down and choosing of the president, what is the real big difference in those two sections?
Tell
I'm
me.
Sorry. I'm not trying to test you. So if you look at it, it's a very minute change, but the real change is that the electors now choose a president and a vice president. In other words, they don't vote on two pieces of paper who they choose for president, and then the person who comes into the, you know, second for the popularity contest becomes the vice president. Now they have to distinctly choose who's to be president and who is to be vice president. And this is what actually allowed, that I know of at least one time, and you probably have the history on this better than I, but we know under Lincoln had a Democratic vice president, where you had a Republican president and a Democratic vice president based on the electors being able to do that. Now, you can't even do that. And so my point is when we look at the 12th Amendment in contrast, the changes it made, those changes are so minute. But the framers back in 1800, when they realized they had this problem, and when was the 12th Amendment suggested? It was suggested in 1803 so that they would never have the problem again because they didn't want to do a repeat. And actually, this was one of the few amendments where Congress took it upon themselves. Hey, we think we need to do this so that we don't go through this long, drawn-out process like what happened in 1800. So they submitted the 12th Amendment, and it got ratified rather quickly so that they could actually implement that process. But the fact of the matter is, it's a very minute change, and the framers said, hey, if you change one minute thing regarding a constitutional process, then you have to amend the Constitution.
Right.
And so the whole point I've been making this with my audience and everybody else that's listening, that when we actually look at what we're doing today, where are the constitutional amendments for the changes for this Electoral College? There's nothing there. This is all tyranny. This is how the parties basically hijack politically this whole process. It's, oh, you guys can do this with statute and regulations. Clearly they can't. So anyway, so to getting back to, because I think this is where you were kind of leading, you know, what we have to do to get back. And I think that you want to go down this path of getting, you know, the Nebraska and the Maine type of model moving forward. I would actually, and I'm really working with state legislators, the few states that I'm in, working, and I'm actually going to be having this conversation later on with a state legislator after we talk today about getting electors to no longer be controlled by the party. In other words, removing the party influence that they get to choose, because by doing so, by the state legislators saying that the party gets to choose who the electors are and not the people, they have determined the outcome. Now, and I say this because you are, you know, the one guy that probably knows the statistics on this. How many people in America are in the Republican and Democratic Party, percentage-wise?
I'm not exactly sure, but I do know that the number of people who are not registered and the number of people who are not Republicans or Democrats is the largest number.
Right.
I believe that the Democratic Party is somewhere in the mid-30s. The Republicans are maybe 5% less, but I believe that the non-Republicans and Democrats is greater, obviously, than either the Republicans or the Democrats.
And so in a Republican form of government, in other words, a representative of representation of the people, how many people are truly being disenfranchised when a 35% portion of the population is determining who gets to be president because it's party affiliated?
Yeah, well, the whole idea of having two parties, I wrote an article called The Two-Party Tyranny, and the fact is that if you have two parties, you're only given the choice between A and B, which means that there is no C, D, E, or F.
Right.
And if you have only two parties, there's going to be a majority and there's going to be a minority, and the majority is going to get everything they want, and the minority is going to be completely disenfranchised.
Right.
That's why we need to have a viable third party to allow the voice of the people to be heard.
Okay, so one of the things, folks, that I really love about talking with Keith is because Keith is so well grounded in the Constitution, he kind of keeps my keel and my mast straight up. And so one of the things I did prepare you for in this conversation that I think that this kind of goes hand in hand, because how the people have no idea how evil the parties have been and how they've hijacked our government. What do you know about the county committeemen?
Not a great deal, other than the little bit that we talked about the other day.
The other day, okay. So what I would suggest, because if we really, because it comes down to this concept of Article 4 in the Constitution that the United States guarantees a representative form of government, a Republican form of government. And if we're supposed to have a Republican form of government, then the party should not be dictating our government. We shouldn't have a partisan form of government. We should have a Republican form of government, representation of the people. And so when we look at the electors, we realize that the parties have taken and hijacked full control of that. In addition, the parties have also hijacked and now control the county committeemen. And so I would suggest as a look, because when we start talking about, you know, how we can really point the finger at both parties, because both parties were the ones that took full control and advantage of this void where people didn't understand, you know, what a Republican form of government was, and everybody was starting to be trained and thought into the concept of democracy, especially back going into the Civil War and so forth. Republicanism was already on the way out. And so the parties, you know, in the 1870s, this is where they started using the politicians to say, you know what, you guys can use statutes and regulations. You don't have to amend the Constitution. They were the soothsayers in taking this country and taking our government down this partisan path. And so my point is that what I want to do is I want to see the state legislators actually get rid of the party's ability to choose, that the people actually have to vote for their electors, period. And that how those electors are chosen will be dictated by the state legislature and nobody else. And then secondly, that those electors will be voting based on how they campaigned. In other words, you know, they're free to vote for whoever they feel is the most conservative and the best at that point in time. This way, we actually have a very large field. And I've talked to the Constitution Party about this. I go, why is it you guys have a ticket? Why do you guys have a president and a vice president in a ticket instead of having, you know, all of the worthy candidates that you think would be a good run for president and nominate 7, 8, or 50 presidential candidates? You don't have to have, I mean, there's nothing that dictates that you have to have a ticket. So why? Start teaching people that, you know, hey, we can have as many candidates in here and the electors should be able to choose any and all these candidates. They cannot boil these things down. And so my point is that if we can get them to actually take away the control of the Electoral College from the parties, we need to also have them at the same time take away the party control of the county representation, because the county committeeman is the person that's supposed to be representing the county when they go to the state legislator, instead of having the full control by the party. So if you haven't researched the history of the county committeeman, now I know John Durash, and have you talked to John? Do you have his number?
I think I do, but I haven't talked to him for quite some time.
So you should have this conversation with him regarding the county committeeman, because he has a lot of history on this. The original states actually used county committeemen, and it was a part of their constitution. I know Missouri, you know, has county committeemen as well. But what they've done is, just like in all the other states, the parties have basically hijacked them, and that the parties actually appoint their county committeemen to going into the state legislature. So,
the county committeemen, they're normally there should only be the one, but now we have one for the Republicans and one for the Democrats and one for the other political parties.
Right. Now, my perspective is this, is that we have an ability to literally move us back, you know, in this big, huge shift of a Republican form of government. And the way to do this, because it's all about election, because we talk about, you know, getting money and getting influence out of the elections, because the people that have representation, the people that are the voters in an election area, whether that be the city, the county, you know, a congressional district and or the state, only those people should have the ability to influence that particular election for their candidates, only them. So taking corporations out, taking, you know, California, taking George Soros out is what we have to do. And I'm not talking about taking them out in the Italian sense, but I'm talking about taking them out of being able to inject any money or inject any type of PAC, any type of influencer into these different races, like what we saw, what happened with the Georgia Senate runoff race with both seats in the Senate going to, you know, the Democrats, because millions and millions of dollars poured in from California, Soros and others to help influence that election. So what the state legislators have to do is they basically have to draw these election boundaries and say nobody or no money can come into these elections that did not come from the area of election. So in other words, if there's a Walmart in that legislative district, in that congressional district, then Walmart can contribute, but they can only contribute from the profits that they made from those stores in that district. Period. And they can't shovel money back and forth from corporate headquarters to influence more than what they can. So in other words, they can only carry the stick that local area is supporting them at. And this would create an accounting nightmare for them. But mom and pa stores, you know, if they're only in that local area, then that means that they'll literally be able to contribute whatever they want to based off of their company profits, but as well as out as their individuals, because they reside there. If you don't reside, if you're a Hollywood star, if you're Bono, I don't care who you are, You cannot come and influence. You say, I endorse this person, because then you're trying to influence an election you have no representation in, and they should make a law that makes that illegal, and basically you get arrested and thrown in jail for trying to influence an election you have no representation in.
Well, it seems to me that the whole idea of the primaries and stuff like that is all part of the problem of the deep state in order to create the control. It seems to me that if these electors are well informed, as they should be, you shouldn't need to have a primary.
Right.
You should just simply allow them to choose the candidate that they feel is the best. And so that basically it's kind of like having a national write-in situation for the electors.
Right. Well, so one of the things that the primary does that the parties play in is if it is a Republican-controlled county primary, then the few Democrats will actually register last minute, or they'll change and they'll actually register as Republicans, and they will vote in the primary. And that's why you'll see hardly any Democratic votes in the primary in that county. There'll be underrepresentation during that election so that they can influence who they want, the rhino. They want to support the guy that's really the Democrat with the Republican label and get them into office. And so we have to stop that, actually. If you're party affiliated, then you have to choose, you have to vote in your, and that's where the primaries will actually feed that. However, they can't play that game in a general election like you're speaking, because this is it. Winner takes all. And so if you're going to vote in and you're not going to vote for, then you may actually take the risk of not having a Democrat on the on the ticket anymore, because if they make it, because a lot of states have a 2% rule. And so they basically say you have to have at least 2% of the votes in each of these elections to be able to have representation on their ballot. And I honestly would see that if they were actually trying to influence a Republican outcome in the general election, then that would actually force them to say, you know what, we have to vote Democrat or we lose our candidate seat, or the placement to be on the ballot for this particular race or in future races as well. Does that make sense?
Okay.
And so I agree. I think the primaries themselves is a huge shenanigan that allows the parties to maneuver in a few different ways. And one of those ways is crossover voting. Believe it or not, it's a real problem in lots of states, and that's what I hear from state legislators and party and everything else. I say constitutionalists in the Republican Party and so forth, they're constantly complaining about the crossover voting problem, especially in the primary. So, because the primaries don't count. It's only the general election that's what really counts, and that's where you have to have that 2%. So if you're going to play that game of trying to influence and get your Democrat in the Republican label, and so here's the other problem, that in that process, the party doesn't do a good job in vetting. And this is for a reason, because the establishment, Republicans and the Democrats, they want their politician, because they work together, they want their politician to be unencumbered by, you know, these vetting rules so that, you know, the people can understand. So one of the things we're doing, because they actually have laws in Wyoming and a lot of other states that basically lay it out, that says the party cannot influence the primary. In other words, they can't pipe in and endorse any candidate prior to the primary. So in other words, they can only endorse candidates for the general election. And by so doing, it ties their hands to say, you know, this guy's a Democrat. They can't endorse anybody. But what they can do, and this is what we're getting them to do, is we're getting them to actually vet with very specific tests, like how we talked about, you know, in qualifying for being a politician, where, you know, you don't have to currently, but you have to qualify to be a florist. Anyway, what we want to do is get the counties to actually create a standard vetting questionnaire test that they all use for both statewide candidates as well as for, you know, the county candidates, city and so forth within the county, by using this vetting questionnaire and everybody having the same. And what it does is it tests the incumbent differently than it tests the challenger who's never been in office. And, you know, what you do is you have, because those questions are different, but the real meat of this question is the Constitution. Do you understand the Constitution? What is, you know, and you actually have I've created 25 questions to test their knowledge and understanding, and it's a tough test. And so if they can't pass it, then the question, all the party has to do is say, this is the test we administered for, you know, vetting the candidates for the primary, and this is how you can basically, you know, look at how well they scored. Instead of endorsing anybody, it's basically publishing the scores of how they scored on their knowledge of the Constitution and so forth. Does that make sense?
Yes, and I, frankly, would appreciate it if you would send me the link so that I could see your 25 questions.
Oh, I'll actually email you the whole vetting questionnaire. But yes. But again, the whole point is, and it's just these conversations and having these types of conversations with, you know, legislators, our representatives, and other political groups. And I don't have time now because, believe it or not, we've already consumed 40 minutes and my show is only 55 minutes long. So what I'll do is I'd like to actually talk to you again about the Constitution Party, about your old Constitution Club and what you're doing with that, because I'd love to actually let people hear how you have a tool that they can actually use for social networking type of purposes, as well as, you know, a lot of other things. And so if we could have you back and we can talk about that. And I think that there's probably a couple more things, but I definitely, we've got a lot of things to talk about, and I'm glad we finally got our connections in Skype working so that you can become a regular contributor, if you don't mind, Keith.
That'd be wonderful.
Awesome. So I want to thank you for coming on, and I want to thank you for your time. And so what we'll do is I'll leave the subject up to you of what you want to talk about next time we come in. But the Electoral College, folks, is a real problem. And as a matter of fact, the last election, we were really stolen. The choosing of the president was stolen from us by an unconstitutional Electoral College, as everybody knows. So we have to start getting people educated so that we understand, and we start demanding that we start complying to the Constitution, because in so doing, we won't be becoming, I just say, victims to this tyranny and to this communist revolution. Keith, before we go, where can people get your articles? Because I know you're prolifically writing, you got classes. Talk about how they can get educated and connect and so forth.
Okay, first off, one of the websites that people can go to is called constitutioneducation.us. It's at https://constitutioneducation.us. I also have many articles published on another website, which is http://constitutionalstudies.ning.com. Those are two. And by the way, the topic that I would like to speak about next is whether or not the secession of the Southern states was authorized under the Constitution. Was it a lawful act to secede or not? And I've got some very compelling evidence to share with everyone.
Awesome. Awesome. I put it out there. That's what we'll cover next then. And so thank you again. With that, folks, we are going to be right back, and I'll do a kind of a recap and cover what more we're going to be talking about. And we will probably have Keith on really soon. So we will be right back after these promos. You know the routine, so stay tuned, and we'll be right back. Thank you so much. And as you can tell, I actually owe Keith a little bit of an apology because I kind of gave him the rapid fire as far as a lot of topics. And I'll explain it when we come back from the break. But it's been a long time since Keith and I have actually had some good extended conversations, and I'll explain why again when we come right back after the break. Thank you so much. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255. Okay, so as I've been on Red State Talk Radio for a few years now, and when we first started, Keith and I kind of connected, and this was before he moved, actually probably before he moved a couple of times, but like kind of constrained our conversation, because many of the conversations he'd bring up these topics like the Electoral College that I said, Keith, I don't want to have this conversation. Because see, one of my shortcomings is that I really don't have a lot of prep, you know, and go by a reading or outline. I mean, I have a rough outline, but when I talk to individuals, I let it take its own volition. And so every time I, in the past, I have talked to individuals prior to interviewing them, before I even came to Red State Talk Radio, I realized that while I was doing the interview, because we had a deep, thorough conversation prior to the interview, I kind of, it's easy to start intermixing what we talked about before and what we were talking about. And then when I listened to the actual interview, I realized, oh, we didn't talk about this and this and this because we actually talked about it before. And I didn't make sure that we brought all those things up. So I have found that it is far better, because a lot of that information, that supporting information that Keith has and or anybody that I'm talking to, I really have gone down almost like a superstitious path of avoiding talking about the topics, so that when we actually talk, you're hearing it for the first time regarding me receiving the information. And it makes it far more dynamic. It makes it far more, I think, realistic. But anyway, there's a lot of things that, you know, obviously Keith wants to talk about the secession, the Civil War, and so forth. And, you know, there's a lot of people that, you know, look at what we've been taught for history. And we're starting to recognize, you know what? There was a lot of bad doing regarding, you know, the Civil War and so forth. So anyway, so I'm looking forward to that conversation. We'll probably have it probably very soon. It'll probably be coming up in the next week or so. But we definitely, in our next episode, will be getting back to the, you know, this multi-page issues listing of getting the Constitution aligned and getting our rights aligned with the 21st century, because there are way too many things that either we don't understand because of our education system has deliberately obfuscated these facts, these truths that we all need to understand, or there are other things that are fundamental that nobody has really put context to, because they go, well, you know, things have just changed because government has grown. Well, no, government hasn't grown based on the Constitution. Government has grown based on usurpation. It has not been delegated. The federal government has not been delegated formally from the states any of these powers, that many of the powers, a plethora of powers, that they have no authority to exercise or execute. So anyway, so when we come back, we will get back into that. I'm actually hoping to do another follow-up with the Independent American Party, because I would like to find out, you know, where they sit, where they stand regarding Republic Review, and, you know, if we can start merging forces, efforts, and so forth with these constitutional parties. And hopefully we can actually start seeing, you know, some headway, because I truly believe, you got to understand that both of these parties, the Independent American Party and the Constitution Party, broke away at the same time. And I'm not sure that they really knew what each other was doing, because they were just starting off. And so it's time to start uniting, folks. Again, united we stand, divided we fall. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. I've been on the radio for a couple of years, and for over a decade, I have been providing content to help patriots understand what has to be done if we're going to save our Constitution and our Republic. Not one academic has been able to refute my argument for Republic Review, and even most conservative entertainers will not support Republic Review due to self-interest reasons. If you have not read my bullet point descriptions and executive summaries, you need to, so that you can understand what we all need to do. I am trying to give patriots the necessary knowledge to take back our Constitution and Republic. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can read my bullet points and view the Republic Review flowchart. You can even order my executive summaries, books, and other content to understand the simplicity of what we have to do. This way, you will know what, why, and how to support the reclaiming of our Republic. Again, please take a look at my content on reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can become a part of the solution.